Yes, sir. You get the officers together, maybe not even all of them, and this would work. Getting 10 or 12 dissidents together is a whole lot easier than assembling 100.
Easier, but hardly easy, Dan, General Hilton objected. For Christ's sake, they have at least one political officer aboard, plus moles from their intelligence outfits. You really think a party hack would go along with this?
Why not? You heard, Ryan. That frigate's mutiny was led by the political officer.
Yeah, and since then they've shaken up the whole directorate, Hilton responded.
We have defecting KGB types all the time. All good party members, Foster said. Clearly he liked the idea of a defecting Russian sub. The president took all this in, then turned to Ryan. Dr. Ryan, you have managed to persuade me that your scenario is a theoretical possibility. Now, what does the CIA think we ought to do about it?
Mr. President, I'm an intelligence analyst, not...
I know very well what you are, Dr. Ryan. I've read enough of your work. I can see you have an opinion. I want to hear it. Ryan didn't even look at Judge Moore.
We grab her, sir.
Just like that.
No, Mr. President, probably not. However, Romulus could surface off the Virginia Capes in a day or two and request political asylum. We ought to be prepared for that contingency, sir, and my opinion is that we should welcome him with open arms.
Ryan saw nods from all the chiefs. Finally, somebody was on his side.
You've stuck your neck out on this one, the president observed kindly.
Sir, you asked me for an opinion. It will probably not be that easy. These alphas and victors appear to be racing for our coast, almost certainly with the intention of establishing an interdiction force, effectively a blockade of our Atlantic coast.
Blockade, the president said.
An ugly word.
Judge, General Hilton said, I suppose it's occurred to you that this is a piece of disinformation aimed at blowing whatever highly placed source generated this report?
Judge Moore affected a sleepy smile.
It has, General. If this is a sham, it's a damned elaborate one. Dr. Ryan was directed to prepare this briefing on the assumption that this data is genuine. If it is not, the responsibility is mine.
God bless you, Judge, Ryan said to himself, wondering just how gold-plated the Willow source was. The judge went on.
In any case, gentlemen, we will have to respond to this Soviet activity whether our analysis is accurate or not.
Are you getting confirmation of this, Judge? The president asked.
Yes, sir, we are working on that.
Good. The president was sitting straight, and Ryan noted his voice became crisper. The judge is correct. We have to react to this, whatever they're really up to. Gentlemen, the Soviet Navy is heading for our coast. What are we doing about it?
Admiral Foster answered first.
Mr. President, our fleet is putting to sea at this moment. Everything that'll steam is out already, or will be by tomorrow night. We've recalled our carriers from the South Atlantic, and we are redeploying our nuclear submarines to deal with this threat. We began this morning to saturate the air over their surface force with P-3C Orion patrol aircraft, assisted by British Nimrods operating out of Scotland.
General? Foster turned to Hilton.
At this moment, we have E-3A Sentry AWACS-type aircraft circling them, along with Dan's Orions, both accompanied by F-15 Eagle fighters out of Iceland. By this time Friday, we'll have a squadron of B-52s operating from Loring Air Force Base in Maine. These will be armed with Harpoon air-to-surface missiles, and they'll be orbiting the Soviets in relays.
Nothing aggressive, you understand, Hilton smiled. Just to let them know we're interested, if they continue to come this way. We will redeploy some tactical air assets to the East Coast, and subject to your approval, we can activate some National Guard and Reserve squadrons quietly.
Just how will you do that quietly? Pelt asked.
Dr. Pelt, we have a number of guard outfits scheduled to run through our red flag facilities at Nellis in Nevada starting this Sunday, a routine training rotation. They go to Maine instead of Nevada. The bases are pretty big, and they belong to SAC. Hilton referred to the Strategic Air Command. They have good security.
How many carriers do we have handy? The president asked.
Only one at the moment, sir, Kennedy. Saratoga stripped a main turbine last week, and it'll take a month to replace. Nimitz and America are both in the South Atlantic right now. America coming back from the Indian Ocean, Nimitz heading out to the Pacific. Bad luck. Can we recall a carrier from the Eastern Med?
No, the president shook his head. This Cyprus thing is still too sensitive.
Do we really need to? If anything, untoward happens. Can we handle their surface force with what we have at hand?
Yes, sir, General Hilton said at once. Dr. Ryan said it. The Atlantic is our ocean. The Air Force alone will have over 500 aircraft designated for this operation, and another 300 or 400 from the Navy. If any sort of shooting match develops, that Soviet fleet will have an exciting and short life.
We will try to avoid that, of course, the President said quietly. The first press report surfaced this morning. We had a call from Bud Wilkins of the Times right before lunch. If the American people find out too soon what the scope of this is... Jeff?
Mr. President, let's assume for the moment that Dr. Ryan's analysis is correct. I don't see what we can do about it, Pelt said.
What? Ryan blurted. I beg your pardon, sir.
We can't exactly steal a Russian missile sub.
Why not? Foster demanded. Hell, we have enough of their tanks and aircraft. The other chiefs agreed.
An aircraft with a crew of one or two is one thing, Admiral. A nuclear-powered submarine with 26 rockets and a crew of over 100 is something else. Naturally, we can give asylum to the defecting officers.
So you're saying that if the thing does come sailing into Norfolk, Hilton joined in, we give it back? Christ, man, it carries 200 warheads. They just might use those goddamn things against us someday, you know. Are you sure you want to give them back?
That's a billion-dollar asset, General, Pelt said diffidently. Ryan saw the President smile. He was said to like lively discussions.
Judge, what are the legal ramifications?
That's admiralty law, Mr. President.
Moore looked uneasy for once.
I've never had an admiralty practice. Takes me all the way back to law school. Admiralty is jugentium. The same legal codes theoretically apply to all countries. American and British admiralty courts routinely cite each other's rulings, but as for the rights that attach to a mutinous crew, I have no idea.
Judge, we are not dealing with mutiny or piracy, Foster noted. The correct term is barratry, I believe. Mutiny is when the crew rebels against lawful authority. Gross misconduct of the officers is called barratry. Anyway, I hardly think we need to attach legal folderol to a situation involving nuclear weapons.
We might, Admiral, the President mused. As Jeff said, this is a highly valuable asset. Legally their property, and they will know we have her. I think we are agreed that not all the crew is likely to be in on this. If so, those not party to the mutiny, barratry, whatever, will want to return home after it's all over, and we will have to let them go, won't we?
Have to? General Maxwell was doodling on a pad.
Have to?
General, the President said firmly, we will not, repeat not, be party to the imprisonment or murder of men whose only desire is to return to home and family. Is that understood? He looked around the table. If they know we have her, they'll want her back, and they will know we have her from the crewmen who want to return home. In any case, big as this thing is, how could we hide her?
We might be able to, Foster said neutrally. But as you say, the crew is a complication. I presume we'll have the chance to look her over.
You mean conduct a quarantine inspection? Check her for seaworthiness? Maybe make sure they're not smuggling drugs into the country? The President grinned.
I think we might arrange that.
But we are getting ahead of ourselves. There's a lot of ground to cover before we get to that point.
What about our allies?
The English just had one of their carriers over here.
Could you use her, Dan? General Hilton asked.
If they let us borrow her, yes. We just finished that ASW exercise south of Bermuda, and the Brits acquitted themselves well. We could use Invincible, the 4 escorts and the 3 attack boats. The force is being recalled at high speed because of this.
Do they know of this development, Judge? The President asked.
Not unless they've developed it themselves. The information is only a few hours old.
Moore did not reveal that Sir Basil had his own ear in the Kremlin. Ryan didn't know much about it himself, had only heard some disconnected rumblings.
With your permission, I've asked Admiral Greer to be ready to fly to England to brief the Prime Minister.
Why not just send... Judge Moore was shaking his head.
Mr. President, this information, let's say it's only delivered by hand.
Eyebrows went up all around the table.
When is he leaving?
This evening, if you wish. There are a couple of VIP flights leaving Andrews tonight. Congressional flights.
It was the usual end-of-session junket season.
Christmas in Europe, on fact-finding missions. General, do we have anything quicker? The President asked Hilton.
We can scratch up a VC-141, Lockheed Jetstar, almost as fast as a 135, and we can have it up in half an hour.
Do it.
Yes, sir, I'll call that in right now.
Hilton rose and walked to a phone in the corner. Judge, tell Greer to pack his bags. I'll have a cover letter waiting for him on the plane to give to the Prime Minister.
Admiral, you want the Invincible?
Yes, sir.
I'll get her for you.
Next, what do we tell our people at sea?
If October just sails in, it won't be necessary. But if we have to communicate with her...
Excuse me, Judge, Ryan said. That is rather likely that we'll have to. They'll probably have these attack boats on the coast before she gets here. If so, we'll have to warn her off, if only to save the defecting officers. They are out to locate and sink her.
We haven't detected her. What makes you think they can? Foster asked, miffed at the suggestion.
They did build her, Admiral, so they might know things about her that will enable them to locate her more easily than us.
Makes sense, the President said. That means somebody goes out to brief the fleet commanders.
We can't broadcast this, can we, Judge?
Mr. President, this source is too valuable to compromise in any way. That's all I can say here, sir.
Very well. Somebody flies out. Next thing is, we'll have to talk to the Soviets about this. For the moment, they can say they're operating in home waters. When will they pass Iceland?
Tomorrow night, unless they change course, Foster answered.
Okay, we give it a day for them to call this off and for us to confirm the report. Judge, I want something to back up this fairy tale in 24 hours. If they haven't turned back by midnight tomorrow, I'll call Ambassador Arbatov into my office Friday morning. He turned to the chiefs. Gentlemen, I want to see contingency plans for dealing with this situation by tomorrow afternoon. We will meet here tomorrow at 2. One more thing. No leaks. This information does not go beyond this room without my personal approval. If this story breaks to the press, I'll have heads on my desk.
Yes, General.
Mr. President, in order to develop those plans, Hilton said after sitting back down, we have to work through our field commanders and some of our own operations people. Certainly we'll need Admiral Blackburn.
Blackburn was Cinquelant, Commander-in-Chief of the Atlantic.
Let me think that one over. I'll be back to you in an hour.
How many people at the CIA know about this?
4, sir. Ritter, Greer, Ryan, and myself, that's all.
Keep it that way.
The President had been bedeviled by security leaks for months.
Yes, Mr. President.
Meeting is adjourned. The President stood. Moore walked around the table to keep him from leaving at once. Dr. Pelt stayed also, as the rest filed out of the room. Ryan stood outside the door.
Well, that was all right. General Maxwell grabbed his hand. He waited until everyone else was a few yards down the hall before going on.
I think you're crazy, son. But you sure put a burr under Dan Foster's saddle. No, even better, I think he got a hard-on. The little general chuckled. And if we get the sub, maybe we can change the president's mind and arrange for the crew to disappear. The judge did that once, you know. It was a thought that chilled Ryan as he watched Maxwell swagger down the hall.
Jack, you want to come back in here for a minute?
Moore's voice called.
You're a historian, right? The president asked, reviewing his notes.
Ryan hadn't even noticed him holding a pen.
Yes, Mr. President, that's what my graduate degree's in.
Ryan shook his hand. You have a fine sense of the dramatic, Jack. You would have made a decent trial lawyer. The President had made his reputation as a hard-driving state's attorney. He had survived an unsuccessful mafia assassination attempt early in his career, which hadn't hurt his political ambitions one bit.
Damn nice briefing.
Thank you, Mr. President, Ryan beamed.
The judge tells me you know the commander of that British task force.
It was like a sandbag hitting his head.
Yes, Admiral White. I've been shooting with him, and our wives are good friends. They're close to the royal family.
Good. Somebody has to fly out to brief our fleet commander, then go on to talk to the Brits. If we get their carrier, as I expect we will. The judge says we ought to let Admiral Davenport go out with you. So you fly out to Kennedy tonight, then on to Invincible.
Mr. President, I...
Come now, Dr. Ryan. Pelt smiled thinly. You are uniquely suited to this. You already have access to the intelligence, you know the British commander, and you're a naval intelligence specialist. You fit. Tell me, How eager do you think the Navy is about getting this Red October?
Of course they're interested in it, sir. To get a chance to look at it, better yet to run it, take it apart, and run it some more. It would be the intelligence coup of all time.
That's true, but maybe they're a little too eager.
I don't understand what you mean, sir, Ryan said, though he understood it just fine. Pelt was the president's favorite. He was not the Pentagon's favorite.
They might take a chance that we might not want them to take.
Dr. Pelt, if you're saying that a uniformed officer would...
He's not saying that. At least, not exactly.
What he's saying is that it might be useful for me to have somebody out there who can give me an independent civilian point of view.
Sir, you don't know me. I've read a lot of your reports.
The chief executive was smiling. It was said he could turn dazzling charm on and off like a spotlight.
Ryan was being blinded, knew it, and couldn't do a thing about it. I like your work. You have a good feel for things, for facts, good judgment.
Now, one reason I got to where I am is good judgment, too. And I think you can handle what I have in mind. The question is, will you do it? Or won't you?
Do what, exactly, sir?
After you get out there, you stay put for a few days and report directly to me. Not through channels, directly to me. You'll get the cooperation you need, I'll see to that.
Ryan didn't say anything. He'd just become a spy. A field officer, by presidential fiat. Worse, he'd be spying on his own side.
You don't like the idea of reporting on your own people, right?
Well, you won't be, not really.
Like I said, I want an independent civilian opinion. We'd prefer to send an experienced case officer out, but we want to minimize the number of people involved in this. Sending Ritter or Greer out would be far too obvious, whereas you, on the other hand, are a relative...
Nobody? Jack asked.
As far as they're concerned, yes, Judge Moore replied. The Soviets have a file on you. I've seen parts of it. They think you're an upper-class drone, Jack.
I am a drone, Ryan thought, unmoved by the implicit challenge. In this company, I sure as hell am.
Agreed. Mr. President, please forgive me for hesitating. I've never been a field officer before.
I understand. The president was magnanimous in victory.
One more thing. If I understand how submarines operate, Ramius could just have taken off, not saying anything. Why tip them off? Why the letter? The way I read this, it's counterproductive.
It was Ryan's turn to smile.
Ever meet a subdriver, sir?
No.
How about an astronaut?
Sure. I've met a bunch of the shuttle pilots.
They're the same breed of cat, Mr. President. As to why he left the letter, there's two parts to that. First, he's probably mad about something, exactly what we'll find out when we see him. Second, he figures he can pull this off regardless of what they try to stop him with. And he wants them to know that. Mr. President, the men who drive subs for a living are aggressive, confident, and very, very smart. They like nothing better than making somebody else, a surface ship operator, for example, look like an idiot.
You just scored another point, Jack. The astronauts I've met, on most things, they're downright humble, but they think they're gods when it comes to flying. I'll keep that in mind. Jeff, let's get back to work. Jack, keep me posted.
Ryan shook his hand again. After the president and his senior advisor left, he turned to Judge Moore.
Judge, what the hell did you tell him about me?
Only the truth, Jack.
Actually, the judge had wanted this operation to be run by one of the CIA's senior case officers. Ryan had not been part of his scheme, but presidents have been known to spoil many carefully laid plans. The judge took this philosophically.
This is a big move up in the world for you, if you do your job right.
Hell, you might even like it. Ryan was sure he wouldn't, and he was right. CIA Headquarters. He didn't speak the whole way back to Langley. The director's car pulled into the basement parking garage, where they got out and entered a private elevator that took them directly to Moore's office. The elevator door was disguised as a wall panel, which was convenient but melodramatic, Ryan thought. The DCI went right to his desk and lifted a phone.
Bob, I need you in here right now,
he glanced at Ryan, standing in the middle of the room.
Looking forward to this, Jack?
Sure, Judge, Ryan said without enthusiasm.
I can see how you feel about this spying business, but the whole thing could develop into an extremely sensitive situation.
He ought to be damn flattered you'd be entrusted with it.
Ryan caught the between-the-lines message, just as Ritter breezed in.
What's up, Judge?
We're laying an operation on. Ryan is flying out to the Kennedy with Charlotte Davenport to brief the fleet commanders on this October business. The President bought it.
Guess so. Greer left for Andrews just before you pulled in. Ryan gets to fly out, eh?
Yes. Jack, the rule is this. You can brief the fleet commander in Davenport, that's all. Same for the Brits, just the boss sailor. If Bob can confirm Willow, the data can be spread out, but only as much as is absolutely necessary. Clear?
Yes, sir.
I suppose somebody has told the President that it's hard to accomplish anything if nobody knows what the hell is going on, especially the guys who are doing the work.
I know what you're saying, Jack. We have to change the President's mind on that. We will.
But until we do, remember, he is the boss. Bob, we'll need to rustle something up so he'll fit in.
Naval officer's uniform. Let's make him a commander. 3 stripes, usual ribbons.
Ritter looked Ryan over.
Say, a 42 long? We can have him outfitted in an hour, I expect. This operation have a name?
That's next.
Moore lifted his phone again and tapped in 5 numbers.
I need 2 words.
Uh-huh.
Thank you.
He wrote a few things down.
Okay, gentlemen, we're calling this Operation Mandolin. You, Ryan, are Magi.
Ought to be easy to remember, given the time of year. We'll work up a series of code words based on those while you're being fitted.
Bob, take him down there yourself. I'll call Davenport and have him arrange the flight.
Ryan followed Ritter to the elevator. It was going too fast. Everyone was being too clever, he thought. This Operation Mandolin was racing forward before they knew what the hell they were going to do, much less how. And the choice of his code name struck Ryan as singularly inappropriate. He wasn't anyone's wise man. The name should have been something more like Halloween. The 7th day. Thursday, 9th December. The North Atlantic. When Samuel Johnson compared sailing in a ship to being in jail with the chance of being drowned, at least he had the consolation of traveling to his ship in a safe carriage, Ryan thought. Now he was going to sea, and before he got to his ship, Ryan stood the chance of being smashed to red pulp in a plane crash. Jack sat hunched in a bucket seat on the port side of a Grumman Greyhound, known to the fleet without affection as a COD, for carrier onboard delivery, a flying delivery truck. The seats, facing aft, were too close together, and his knees jutted up against his chin. The cabin was far more amenable to cargo than to people. There were 3 tons of engine and electronics parts stowed in crates aft, there, no doubt, so that the impact of a plane crash on the valuable equipment would be softened by the 4 bodies in the passenger section. The cabin was not heated. There were no windows. A thin aluminum skin separated him from a 200-knot wind that shrieked in time with the twin turbine engines. Worst of all, they were flying through a storm at 5,000 feet, and the COD was jerking up and down in 100-foot gulps like a berserk roller coaster. The only good thing was the lack of lighting, Ryan thought. At least nobody can see how green my face is. Right behind him were 2 pilots, talking away loudly so they could be heard over the engine noise. The bastards were enjoying themselves. The noise lessened somewhat, or so it seemed. It was hard to tell. He'd been issued foam rubber ear protectors along with a yellow inflatable life preserver and a lecture on what to do in the event of a crash. The lecture had been perfunctory enough that it took no great intellect to estimate their chances of survival if they did crash on a night like this. Ryan hated flying. He had once been a Marine second lieutenant, and his active career had ended after only 3 months when his platoon's helicopter had crashed on Crete during a NATO exercise. He had injured his back, nearly been crippled for life, and ever since regarded flying as something to be avoided. The COD, he thought, was bouncing more down than up. It probably meant that they were close to the Kennedy. The alternative did not bear thinking about. They were only 90 minutes out of Oceana Naval Air Station at Virginia Beach. It felt like a month, and Ryan swore to himself that he'd never be afraid on a civilian airliner again. The nose dropped about 20 degrees, and the aircraft seemed to be flying right at something. They were landing, the most dangerous part of carrier flight operations. He remembered a study conducted during the Vietnam War in which carrier pilots had been fitted with portable electrocardiographs to monitor stress, and it had surprised a lot of people that the most stressful time for carrier pilots wasn't while they were being shot at. It was while they were landing, particularly at night. "Christ, you're full of happy thoughts," Ryan told himself. He closed his eyes. One way or another, it would be over in a few seconds. The deck was slick with rain and heaving up and down, a black hole surrounded by perimeter lights. The carrier landing was a controlled crash. Massive landing gear struts and shock absorbers were needed to lessen the bone-crushing impact. The aircraft surged forward, only to be jerked to a halt by the arresting wire. They were down. They were safe. Probably. After a moment's pause, the COD began moving forward again. Ryan heard some odd noises as the plane taxied and realized that they came from the wings folding up. The one danger he had not considered was flying on an aircraft whose wings were supposed to collapse. It was, he decided, just as well. The plane finally stopped moving, and the rear hatch opened. Ryan flipped off his seatbelts and stood rapidly, banging his head on the low ceiling. He didn't wait for Davenport. With his canvas bag clutched to his chest, he darted out of the rear of the aircraft. He looked around and was pointed to the Kennedy's Island structure by a yellow-shirted deck crewman. The rain was falling heavily, and he felt, rather than saw, that the carrier was indeed moving on the 15-foot seas. He ran towards an open, lighted hatch 50 feet away. He had to wait for Davenport to catch up. The Admiral didn't run. He walked with a precise, 30-inch step, dignified as a flag officer should be. And Ryan decided that he was probably annoyed that his semi-secret arrival prohibited the usual ceremony of bosun's pipes and side boys. There was a Marine standing inside the hatch, a corporal, resplendent in striped blue trousers, khaki shirt and tie, and snow-white pistol belt. He saluted, welcoming both aboard.
"Corporal, I want to see Admiral Painter."
"The Admiral's in flag quarters, sir. Do you require escort?"
"No, son. I used to command this ship."
"Come along, Jack." Ryan got to carry both bags.
"God, sir, you actually used to do this for a living?" Ryan asked.
"Night carrier landings? Sure. Done a couple hundred. What's the big deal?"
Davenport seemed surprised at Ryan's awe. Jack was sure it was an act.
Inside of the Kennedy was much like the interior of the USS Guam, the helicopter assault ship Ryan had been assigned to during his brief military career. It was the usual Navy maze of steel bulkheads and pipes, everything painted the same shade of cave gray. The pipes had some colored bands and stenciled acronyms, which probably meant something to the men who ran the ship. To Ryan, they might as well have been Neolithic cave paintings. Davenport led him through a corridor, around a corner, down a ladder made entirely of steel and so steep he almost lost his balance, down another passageway, and around another corner. By this time, Ryan was thoroughly lost. They came to a door with a Marine stationed in front. The sergeant saluted perfectly and opened the door for them. Ryan followed Davenport in and was amazed. Flag quarters on the USS Kennedy might have been transported as a block from a Beacon Hill mansion. To his right was a wall-sized mural large enough to dominate a big living room, a half-dozen oils, one of them a portrait of the ship's namesake, President John Fitzgerald Kennedy, dotted the other walls, themselves covered with expensive-looking paneling. The deck was covered in thick crimson wool, and the furniture was pure civilian, French provincial, oak and brocade. One could almost imagine they were not aboard a ship at all, except that the ceiling, overhead, had the usual collection of pipes, all painted gray. It was a decidedly odd contrast to the rest of the room.
"Hiya, Charlie," Rear Admiral Joshua Painter emerged from the next room, drying his hands with a towel. "How was it coming in?"
"Little rocky," Davenport allowed, shaking hands.
"This is Jack Ryan."
Ryan had never met Painter, but knew him by reputation. A phantom pilot during the Vietnam War, he had written a book, Paddy Strikes, on the conduct of the air campaigns. It had been a truthful book, not the sort of thing that wins friends. He was a small, feisty man who could not have weighed more than 130 pounds. He was also a gifted tactician and a man of puritanical integrity.
"One of yours, Charlie?"
"No, Admiral. I work for James Greer. I am not a naval officer. Please accept my apologies. I don't like pretending to be what I'm not. The uniform was the CIA's idea." This drew a frown.
Ah, well, I suppose that means you're going to tell me what Ivan's up to. Good. I hope to hell somebody knows. First time on a carrier? How'd you like the flight in?
Might be a good way to interrogate prisoners of war, Ryan said offhandedly as he could. The two flag officers had a good laugh at his expense, and Painter called for some food to be sent in. The double doors to the passageway opened several minutes later, and a pair of stewards, mess management specialists, came in, one bearing a tray of food, the other two pots of coffee. The three men were served in a style appropriate to their rank. The food, served on silver-trimmed plates, was simple but appetizing to Ryan, who hadn't eaten in 12 hours. He dished coleslaw and potato salad onto his plate, and selected a pair of corned beef on rice.
"Thank you, that's all for now," Painter said. The stewards came to attention before leaving. "Okay, let's get down to business."
Ryan gulped down half a sandwich. "Admiral, this information is only 20 hours old." He took the briefing folders from his bag and handed them around. His delivery took 20 minutes, during which he managed to consume the 2 sandwiches and a goodly portion of his coleslaw and spill coffee and his handwritten notes. The 2 flag officers were a perfect audience, not interrupting once, only darting a few disbelieving looks at him.
"God almighty," Painter said when Ryan finished.
Davenport just stared poker-faced as he contemplated the possibility of examining a Soviet missile sub from the inside. Jack decided he'd be a formidable opponent over cards. Painter went on.
"Do you really believe this?"
"Yes, sir, I do." Ryan poured himself another cup of coffee. He would have preferred a beer to go with his corned beef. It hadn't been bad at all, and good kosher corned beef was something he'd been unable to find in London. Painter leaned back and looked at Davenport.
"Charlie, you tell Greer to teach this lad a few lessons, like how a bureaucrat ain't supposed to stick his neck this far out on the block. Don't you think this is a little far-fetched?"
"Josh, Ryan here's the guy who did the report last June on Soviet missile sub-patrol patterns."
"Oh, that was a nice piece of work. It confirms something I've been saying for 2 or 3 years."
Painter rose and walked to the corner to look out at the stormy sea.
"So what are we supposed to do about all this?"
"The exact details of the operation have not been determined. What I expect is that you will be directed to locate Red October and attempt to establish communications with her skipper. After that, we'll have to figure out a way to get her to a safe place. You see, the President doesn't think we'll be able to hold on to her once we get her. If we get her."
"What?"
Painter spun around and spoke a tenth of a second before Davenport did. Ryan explained for several minutes.
"Dear God above, you give me one impossible task, then you tell me that if we succeed in it, we gotta give the goddamn thing back to them?"
"Admiral, my recommendation, the President asked me for one, was that we keep the submarine. For what it's worth, the Joint Chiefs are on your side too, along with the CIA. As it is, though, if the crewmen want to go back home, we have to send them back, and then the Soviets will know we have the boat for sure. As a practical matter, I can see the other side's point. The vessel is worth a pile of money, and it is their property. And how would we hide a 30,000-ton submarine?"
"You hide a submarine by sinking it," Painter said angrily. "They're designed to do that, you know."
"Their property. We're not talking about a damn passenger liner. That's something designed to kill people. Our people."
"Admiral, I am on your side," Ryan said quietly.
"Sir, you said we've given you an impossible task. Why?"
"Ryan, finding a boomer that does not want to be found is not the easiest thing in the world. We practice against our own. We damn near always fail, and you say this one's already past all the Northeast SOSUS lines. The Atlantic's a rather large ocean, and a missile sub's noise footprint is very small."
"Yes, sir," Ryan noted to himself that he might have been overly optimistic about their chances for success.
"What sort of shape are you in, Josh?" Davenport asked.
"Pretty good, really. The exercise we just ran, Nifty Dolphin, worked out all right."
"Our part of it," Painter corrected himself. "Dallas raised some hell on the other side. My ASW crews are functioning very well. What sort of help are we getting?"
"When I left the Pentagon, the CNO was checking the availability of P-3s out on the Pacific, so you'll probably be seeing more of those. Everything that'll move is putting to sea. You're the only carrier, so you've got overall tactical command, right? Come on, Josh. You're our best ASW operator."
Painter poured some coffee for himself.
"Okay, we have one carrier, Dick. America and Nimitz are still a good week away. Ryan, you said you're flying out to Invincible. We get her too, right?"
"The President was working on that. Want her?"
Sure. Admiral White has a good nose for ASW, and his boys really lucked out during Dolphin. They killed two of our attack boats, and Vince Gallery was some kind of pissed about that. Luck's a big part of this game. That would give us two decks instead of one. I wonder if we can get some more S-3s. Painter referred to the Lockheed Vikings, carrier-borne anti-submarine aircraft. Why? Davenport asked. I can transfer my F-18s to shore, and that'll give us room for 20 more Vikings. I don't like losing the striking power, but what we're going to need is more ASW muscle. That means more S-3s. Jack, you know that if you're wrong, that Ruski surface force is going to be a handful to deal with. You know how many surface-to-surface missiles they're packing? No, sir. Ryan was certain it was too many. We're one carrier, and that makes us their primary target. If they start shooting at us, it'll get awful lonesome. Then, it'll get awful exciting. The phone rang. Painter here. Yes, thank you. Well, Invincible just turned around. Good. They're giving her to us, along with two tin cans. The rest of the escorts and the three attack subs are still heading home. He frowned. I can't really fault them for that. That means we have to give them some escorts. But it's a good trade. I want that flight deck. Can we chopper Jack out to her? Ryan wondered if Davenport knew what the President had ordered him to do. The Admiral seemed interested in getting him off the Kennedy. Painter shook his head. Too far for a chopper. Maybe they can send a Harrier back for him. The Harrier's a fighter, sir, Ryan commented. They have an experimental two-seat version set up for ASW patrolling. It's supposed to work reasonably well outside their helo perimeter. That's how they bagged one of our attack boats, caught her napping. Painter finished off the last of his coffee. Okay, gentlemen, let's get ourselves down to ASW control and try to figure a way to run this circus act. Sinclant will want to hear what I have in mind. I suppose I'd better decide for myself. We'll also call Invincible and have them send a bird back to ferry you out, Ryan. Ryan followed the two admirals out of the room. He spent 2 hours watching Painter move ships around the ocean like a chess master with his pieces. The USS Dallas. Bart Mancuso had been on duty in the attack center for more than 20 hours. Only a few hours of sleep separated this stretch from the previous one. He had been eating sandwiches and drinking coffee, and 2 cups of soup had been thrown in by his cooks for variety's sake. He examined his latest cup of freeze-dried without affection. Captain, he turned. It was Roger Thompson, his sonar officer. Yes, what is it? Mancuso pulled himself away from the tactical display that had occupied his attention for several days. Thompson was standing at the rear of the compartment. Jones was standing beside him, holding a clipboard and what looked like a tape machine. Sir, Jonesy has something I think you ought to look at. Mancuso didn't want to be bothered. Extended time on duty always taxed his patience. But Jones looked eager and excited. Okay, come on over to the chart table. The Dallas's chart table was a new gadget wired into the BC-10 and projected onto a TV-type glass screen 4 feet square. The display moved as the Dallas moved. This made paper charts obsolete, though they were kept anyway. Charts can't break. Thanks, Skipper, Jones said, more humbly than usual. I know you're kinda busy, but I think I got something here. That anomalous contact we had the other day's been bothering me. I had to leave it after the ruckus the other Ruski subs kicked up, but I was able to come back to it 3 times to make sure it was still there. The 4th time, it was gone, faded out. I want to show you what I worked up. Can you punch up our course track for back then on this baby, sir? The chart table was interfaced through the BC-10 into the ship's inertial navigation system, SINS. Mancuso punched the command in himself. It was getting so that you couldn't flush the head without a computer command. The Dallas's course track showed up as a convoluted red line, with tick marks displayed at 15-minute intervals. Great, Jones commented. I've never seen it do that before. That's all right. Okay. Jones pulled a handful of pencils from his back pocket. Now, I got the contact first, at 0915 or so, and the bearing was about 269. He set a pencil down, eraser at Dallas's position, point directed west towards the target. Then at 0930, it was bearing 260. At 0948, it was 250. There's some error built into these, Captain. It was a tough signal to lock in on, but the errors should average out. Right about then, we got all this other activity, and I had to go after them, but I came back to it about 10-100, and the bearing was 242. Jones set down another pencil on the due east line traced when the Dallas had moved away from the Icelandic coast. At 10:15, it was 234, and at 10:30, it was 227. These last two are shaky, sir. The signal was real faint, and I didn't have a very good lock on it. Jones looked up. He appeared nervous.
So far, so good. Relax, Jonesy. Light up if you want.
Thanks, Captain. Jones fished out a cigarette and lit it with a butane lighter. He had never approached the captain quite this way. He knew Mancuso to be a tolerant, easygoing commander, if you had something to say. He was not a man who liked his time wasted, and it was sure as hell he wouldn't want it wasted now.
Okay, sir, we gotta figure he couldn't be too far away from us, right? I mean, he had to be between us and Iceland. So let's say he was about halfway between. That gives him a course about like this.
Jones set down some more pencils.
Hold it, Jonesy. Where does the course come from?
Oh, yeah. Jones flipped open his clipboard. Yesterday morning, night, whatever it was, after I got off watch, it started bothering me. So I used the move we made offshore as a baseline to do a little course track for him. I know how. Skipper, I read the manual. It's easy. Just like we used to do at Caltech to chart star motion. I took an astronomy course in my freshman year.
Mancuso stifled a groan. It was the first time he'd ever heard this called easy. But on looking at Jones's figures and diagrams, it appeared that he had done it right.
Go on.
Jones pulled a Hewlett-Packard scientific calculator from his pocket, and what looked like a National Geographic map, liberally coated with pencil marks and scribblings.
You want to check my figures, sir?
We will, but I'll trust you for now. What's the map?
Skipper, I know it's against the rules and all, but I keep this as a personal record of the tracks the bad guys use. It doesn't leave the boat, sir, honest. I may be a little off, but all this translates to a course about 220 and a speed of 10 knots, and that aims him right at the entrance of Route 1, okay?
Go on.
Mancuso had already figured that one. Jonesy was on to something.
Well, I couldn't sleep after that, so I skipped back to sonar and pulled the tape on the contact. I had to run it through the computer a few times to filter out all the crap, sea sounds, the other subs, you know. Then I re-recorded it at 10 times normal speed. He set his cassette recorder on the chart table.
Listen to this, Skipper.
The tape was scratchy, but every few seconds there was a thrum. 2 minutes of listening seemed to indicate a regular interval of about 5 seconds. By this time, Lieutenant Mannion was looking over Thompson's shoulder, listening and nodding speculatively.
Skipper, that's gotta be a man-made sound. It's just too regular for anything else. At normal speed, it didn't make much sense. But once I speeded it up, I had the sucker.
Okay, Jonesy, finish it, Mancuso said.
Captain, what you just heard was the acoustical signature of a Russian submarine. He was heading for Route 1, taking the inshore track off the Icelandic coast. You can bet money on that, Skipper.
Roger.
He sold me, Captain, Thompson replied.
Mancuso took another look at the course track, trying to figure an alternative. There wasn't any.
Me too, Roger. Jonesy makes sonar man first class today. I want to see the paperwork done by the turn of the next watch, along with a nice letter of commendation for my signature on.
He poked the sonar man in the shoulder. That's all right. Damn well done.
Thanks, Skipper.
Jones' smile stretched from ear to ear. Pat, please call Lieutenant Butler to the attack center.
Mannion went to the phone to call the boat's chief engineer.
Any idea what it is, Jonesy?
Mancuso turned back.
The sonar man shook his head.
It isn't screw sounds. I've never heard anything like it.
He ran the tape back and played it again.
2 minutes later, Lieutenant Earl Butler came into the attack center.
You rang, Skipper?
Listen to this, Earl.
Mancuso rewound the tape and played it a third time. Butler was a graduate of the University of Texas, and every school the Navy had for submarines and their engine systems.
What's that supposed to be?
Jonesy says it's a Russian sub.
I think he's right.
Tell me about the tape, Butler said to Jones.
Sir, it speeded up 10 times, and I watched it through the BC-10 5 times. At normal speed, it doesn't sound like much of anything.
With uncharacteristic modesty, Jones did not point out that it had sounded like something to him.
Some sort of harmonic, I mean. If it was a propeller, it'd have to be 100 feet across, and we'd be hearing one blade at a time. The regular intervals suggest some sort of harmonic. Butler's face screwed up. But a harmonic what?
Whatever it was headed right here. Mancuso tapped Thor's twins with his pencil.
That makes him a Russian, all right, Butler agreed. Then they're using something new, again.
Mr. Butler's right, Jones said. It does sound like a harmonic rumble. The other funny thing is, well, there was this background noise, kind of like water going through a pipe. I don't know, it didn't pick up on this. I guess the computer filtered it off. It was real faint to start with. Anyway, that's outside my field.
That's all right. You've done enough for one day. How do you feel? Mancuso asked.
A little tired, Skipper. I've been working on this for a while.
If we get close to this guy again, you think you can track him down?
Mancuso knew the answer.
You bet, Captain. Now that we know what to listen for? You bet, I'll beg the sucker.
Mancuso looked at the chart table. Okay, if he was heading for the twins, and then ran the route at, say, 28 or 30 knots, and then settled down to his base course and speed of about 10 or so, that puts him about here now, long ways off. Now, if we run at top speed, 48 hours will put us here, and that'll put us in front of him. Pat?
That's about right, sir, Lieutenant Mannion concurred.
You're figuring you ran the route at full speed and then settled down. Makes sense. He wouldn't need the quiet drive in that damn maze. Gives him a free shot for 400 or 500 miles, so why not uncrank his engines? That's what I'd do.
That's what we'll try to do, then. We'll radio in for permission to leave Tollbooth Station and track this character down. Jonesy, running at max speed means your sonar man will be out of work for a while. Set up the contact tape on the simulator. Make sure the operators all know what this guy sounds like. But get some rest. All of you. I want you at 100% when we try to reacquire this guy. Have yourself a shower. Make that a Hollywood shower. You've earned it. And rack out. When we do go after this character, it'll be a long, tough hunt.
No sweat, Captain. We'll get him for you. You bet on it. You want to keep my tape, sir?
Yeah. Mancuso ejected the tape and looked up in surprise.
You sacrificed a Bach for this?
Not a good one, sir. I have a Christopher Hogwood of this piece. That's much better.
Mancuso pocketed the tape.
Dismissed, Jonesy. Nice work.
A pleasure, Captain.
Jones left the attack center counting the extra money for jumping a rate.
Roger, make sure your people are well rested over the next 2 days. When we do go after this guy, it's going to be a bastard.
Aye, Captain.
Pat, get us up to periscope depth. We're going to call this one into Norfolk right now. Earl, I want you thinking about what's making that noise.
Right, Captain.
While Mancuso drafted his message, Lieutenant Mannion brought the Dallas to periscope antenna depth with an upward angle on the diving planes. It took 5 minutes to get from 500 feet to just below the stormy surface. The submarine was subject to wave action, and while it was very gentle by surface ship standards, the crew noted her rocking. Mannion raised the periscope and ESM. Electronic support measures, antenna. The latter used for the broadband receiver designed to detect possible radar emissions. There was nothing in view. He could see about 5 miles, and the ESM instruments showed nothing except for aircraft sets, which were too far away to matter. Next, Mannion raised 2 more masts. One was a reed-like UHF, ultra-high frequency, receiving antenna. The other was new, a laser transmitter. This rotated and locked onto the carrier wave signal of the Atlantic SSIX, the communications satellite used exclusively by submarines. With the laser, they could send high-density transmissions without giving away the sub's position.
All ready, sir, the duty radio man reported.
Transmit.
The radio man pressed a button. The signal, sent in a fraction of a second, was received by photovoltaic cells, read over to a UHF transmitter, and shot back down by a parabolic dish antenna towards Atlantic Fleet Communications Headquarters. At Norfolk, another radio man noted the reception and pressed a button that transmitted the same signal up to the satellite and back to the Dallas. It was a simple way to identify garbles. The Dallas operators compared the received signal with the one he'd just sent.
Good copy, sir.
Mancuso ordered Mannion to lower everything but the ESM and UHF antenna. Atlantic Fleet Communications. In Norfolk, the first line of the dispatch revealed the page and line of the one-time pad cipher sequence.
which was recorded on computer tape in the maximum security section of the communications complex. An officer typed the proper numbers into his computer terminal, and an instant later the machine generated a clear text. The officer checked it again for garbles. Satisfied there were none, he took the printout to the other side of the room, where a yeoman was seated at a telex. The officer handed him the dispatch. The yeoman keyed up the proper addressee and transmitted the message by dedicated landline to Comm Sudland operations half a mile away. The landline was fiber optic, located in a steel conduit under a paved street. It was checked 3 times a week for security purposes. Not even the secrets of nuclear weapons performance were as closely guarded as day-to-day tactical communications. Comm Sudland Operations. A bell went off in the operations room as the message came up on the hot printer. It bore a Z prefix, which indicated flash priority status. Z090414ZDEC. Top Secret Theo. From USS Dallas. 2. Comm Sublant. Info. Sinklant FLT. /N00000/. Red Fleet Subops. 1. Report anomalous sonar contact about 0900Z7DEC and lost after increase in Red Fleet sub activity. Contact subsequently evaluated as Red Fleet SSN/SSBN. Transiting Iceland inshore track towards Route 1. Course southwest, speed 10, depth unknown. 2. Contact evidenced unusual, repeat unusual acoustical characteristics. Signature unlike any known Red Fleet submarine. 3. Request permission to leave toll booth to pursue and investigate. Believe a new drive system with unusual sound characteristics being used this sub. Believe good probability can locate and identify. A lieutenant junior grade took the dispatch to the office of Vice Admiral Vincent Gallery. Comm Sublant had been on duty since the Soviet subs had started moving. He was in an evil mood.
A flash priority from Dallas, sir.
Uh-huh. Gallery took the yellow form and read it twice. What do you suppose this means?
No telling, sir. Looks like he heard something, took his time figuring it out, and wants another crack at it. He seems to think he's onto something unusual.
Okay. What do I tell him? Come on, mister. You might be an admiral yourself someday and have to make decisions. An unlikely prospect, Gallery thought.
Sir, Dallas is in an ideal position to shadow their surface force when it gets to Iceland. We need her where she is.
Good textbook answer. Gallery smiled up at the youngster, preparing to cut him off at the knees. On the other hand, Dallas is commanded by a fairly competent man who wouldn't be bothering us unless he really thought he had something. He doesn't go into specifics, probably because it's too complicated for a tactical flash dispatch, and also because he thinks that we know his judgment is good enough to take his word on something. New drive system with unusual sound characteristics. That may be a crock, but he's the man on the scene, and he wants an answer. We tell him yes.
Aye, aye, sir, the lieutenant said, wondering if the skinny old bastard made decisions by flipping a coin when his back was turned.
The Dallas. Z090432ZDEC. Top Secret. From Comm Sudland. 2. USS Dallas. A. USS Dallas Z090414ZDEC. B. Comm Sublant, INST 2000.5. Op Area Assignment, N04220. 1. Request, Ref A, granted. 2. Areas Bravo Echo Golf, Ref B, assigned for unrestricted ops, 090500Z, 2140001Z. Report as necessary. VADM, Gallery sends.
Hot damn, Manguzo chuckled. That was one nice thing about Gallery. When you asked him a question, by God, you got an answer, yes or no, before you could rig your antenna in. Of course, he reflected, if it turned out that Jonesy was wrong and this was a wild goose chase, he'd have some explaining to do. Gallery had handed more than one subskipper his head in a bag and set him on the beach, which was where he was headed regardless, Mancuso knew. Since his first year at Annapolis, all he had ever wanted was command of his own attack boat. He had that now, and he knew that the rest of his career would be downhill. In the rest of the Navy, your first command was just that, a first command. You could move up the ladder and command a fleet at sea eventually, if you were lucky and had all the right stuff. Not submariners, though. Whether he did well with the Dallas or poorly, he'd lose her soon enough. He had this one and only chance. And afterwards, what? The best he could hope for was command of a missile boat. He'd served on those before and was sure that commanding one, even a new Ohio, was about as exciting as watching paint dry. The boomer's job was to stay hidden. Mancuso wanted to be the hunter. That was the exciting end of the business. And after commanding a missile boat, he could get a major surface command, perhaps a nice oiler, and it would be like switching mounts from Secretariat to Elsie the Cow. Or he could get a squadron command and sit in an office on board a tender pushing paper. At best, in that position, he'd go to sea once a month, his main purpose being to bother subskippers who didn't want him there. Or he could get a desk job in the Pentagon. What fun! Mancuso understood why some of the astronauts had cracked up after coming back from the moon. He, too, had worked many years for this command, and in another year, his boat would be gone. He'd have to give the Dallas to someone else. But he did have her now. "Pat, let's lower all masts and take her down to 1,200 feet."
"Aye, aye, sir. Lower the masts," Mannion ordered. A petty officer pulled on the hydraulic control levers.
"ESM and UHF masts lowered, sir," the duty electrician reported.
"Very well. Diving officer, make your depth 1,200 feet."
1,200 feet, aye," the diving officer responded. 15 degrees down angle on the planes."
15 degrees down, aye."
"Let's move her, Pat."
"Aye, skipper. All ahead full."
"All ahead full, aye." The helmsman reached up to turn the annunciator. Mancuso watched his crew at work. They did their jobs with mechanistic precision, but they were not machines. They were men. His. In the reactor spaces aft, Lieutenant Butler had his engine men acknowledge the command and gave the necessary orders. The reactor coolant pumps went to fast speed. An increased amount of hot, pressurized water entered the exchanger, where its heat was transferred to the steam on the outside loop. When the coolant returned to the reactor, it was cooler than it had been, and therefore denser. Being denser, it trapped more neutrons in the reactor pile, increasing the ferocity of the fission reaction and giving off yet more power. Farther aft, saturated steam in the outside or non-radioactive loop of the heat exchange system emerged through clusters of control valves to strike the blades of the high-pressure turbine. The Dallas's huge bronze screw began to turn more quickly, driving her forward and down. The engineers went about their duties calmly. The noise in the engine spaces rose noticeably as the systems began to put out more power, and the technicians kept track of this by continuously monitoring the banks of instruments under their hands. The routine was quiet and exact. There was no extraneous conversation, no distraction. Compared to a submarine's reactor spaces, a hospital operating room was a den of libertines. Forward, Mannion watched the depth gauge go below 600 feet. The diving officer would wait until they got to 900 feet before starting to level off, the object being to zero the dive out exactly at the ordered depth. Commander Mancuso wanted the Dallas below the thermocline. This was the border between differing temperatures. Water settled in isothermal layers of uniform stratification. The relatively flat boundary, where warmer surface water met colder deep water, was a semi-permeable barrier which tended to reflect sound waves. Those waves that did manage to penetrate the thermocline were mostly trapped below it. Thus, though the Dallas was now running below the thermocline at over 30 knots and making as much noise as she was capable of, she would still be difficult to detect with surface sonar. She would also be largely blind, but then there was not much down there to run into. Mancuso lifted the microphone for the PA system.
"This is the captain speaking. We have just started a speed run that will last 48 hours. We are heading toward the point where we hope to locate a Russian sub that went past us 2 days ago. This Ruski is evidently using a new and rather quiet propulsion system that nobody's run across before. We're going to try and get ahead of him and track on him as he passes us again. This time we know what to listen for, and we'll get a nice clear picture of him. Okay, I want everyone on this boat to be well rested. When we get there, it'll be a long, tough hunt. I want everybody at 100%. This one will probably be interesting.
He switched off the microphone.
What's the movie tonight?
The diving officer watched the depth gauge stop moving before answering. As chief of the boat, he was also manager of the Dallas's cable TV system, three video cassette recorders in the